From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Muslim observance of Eid al-Adha ends on September 26th. Sundown on the 27th marks the beginning of Sukkot for followers of Judaism. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Mr. Speaker, the Pope of the Holy See.
All eyes were on Capitol Hill this week as Pope Francis made an unprecedented address to a joint session of Congress. I'll talk with Rabbi Jack Moline about what we heard, and I guess we'll also have to address how Ben Carson, one of the front runners in the GOP race for the White House, demonstrated a shocking ignorance of our secular constitution.
Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently.
In January, we'll be celebrating 10 years of State of Belief Radio. Leading up to that anniversary, we're looking back at some of our favorite interviews from more than 500 past shows, and we'll have another memorable flashback later this week. But first,
I thank you for your welcome. God bless America.
On Wednesday, 15,000 guests gathered on the White House lawn to welcome Pope Francis on his first visit to the United States. Remarkably, characters like Mike Huckabee and Franklin Graham, among others, couldn't contain their outrage at what they claimed was a slap in the face to the Holy Father, allowing a handful of those guests to be dissidents on culture war issues. Now, never mind that Pope Francis has far more frequently talked about how crucial addressing economic injustice and the environment crisis is, and that a number of prominent self-identified Catholics and other conservatives freely dissent with him on his marquee issues, there was no litmus test for the White House event on that score. But just imagine, Sister Simone Campbell, the original nun on the bus, the Right Reverend Gene Robinson, the first openly gay bishop consecrated in the Episcopal Church, and a couple of others were in the crowd, and it seemed to ruin Huckabee's and Franklin's whole day. Well, it didn't ruin mine. And joining me right now is my friend, Bishop Gene Robinson, who I gather managed to rise above that rhetorical skirmish as well. Gene, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Welton, I am so glad to be here.
I know this has been a crazy, demanding week for you in Washington with the Pope in town.
I tell you, Washington has been sort of a flutter these last few days. Yeah. Yesterday, I was up at 3:30 in the morning to be at the White House by 5 o'clock for the Pope at 9 o'clock. Mm. So it was a long day.
I bet. Well, listen, you were asked to offer the closing prayer at Barack Obama's first inauguration. So, quite frankly, it would have been pretty shocking if you had not been at the White House with the Pope and the President. Tell me what it was like.
You know, the feeling amongst the crowd was very like President Obama's first inauguration. It's interesting that you mentioned that because, you know, on those two occasions, the crowd just seemed to be in such a good humor. Their spirits were not going to be dampened by anything. Mm-hmm. And everyone just seemed to be so delighted and honored to be there. And so it was already uplifting before the Pope even arrived. And then, of course, with his wonderful spirit, everyone's spirit continued to rise. It was a humbling moment. It felt historic. And I think everyone just had a wonderful, wonderful time.
In looking around you, was there anybody that you were surprised was there, or was there anybody missing that you were surprised were not there?
You know, this was meant to be the American welcome of the Pope. Mm-hmm. And as I looked around, it seemed to me that those who had been in charge of the invitation list wanted it to, that crowd, to represent the diversity that is America. Mm-hmm. And I think they did a wonderful job with that. There were all ages, there were all races, there were just an extraordinarily diverse example of the diversity in God's creation.
Mm.
And in that way, I think it was just really appropriate in every way.
Gene, watching on television, it certainly looked like the Pope and the President had a very warm rapport. What was your sense of that being there?
Yeah, it felt that way to us as well. And I'm wondering whether or not the Pope's involvement in the recent negotiations to bring the United States and Cuba back into relation with one another hasn't contributed to that. And we certainly saw when the Pope addressed Congress that the one person he stopped and shook hands with was John Kerry. So my guess is that those rather secret negotiations, and certainly the Vatican's role in them was unknown, has really helped to establish a quite personal relationship between the Pope and the United States, its Secretary of State John Kerry, and its President Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. Gene, what else in that welcoming event really made an impression on you?
You know, I think this has been true of all the speaking engagements that the Pope has had here, which is there is something in his speeches for everyone to love and something in there for everyone to hate.
Mm-hmm.
This Pope is not ideological in the traditional sense that you could classify him as liberal or conservative. This does seem to be a man who lives by and is guided by his beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
After all, as religious people, that's kind of what we hope for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's not to say that I, for one, and probably everyone who listens to him, doesn't find something with which they disagree. And yet I think the overwhelming feeling for most people is that this is an extraordinarily holy man. And I would actually put him in the category along with, say, the Dalai Lama or Archbishop Desmond Tutu. This is a very small number of religious leaders that seem to transcend all the denominational boundaries as well as boundaries between our faith. And I think that's why this feels like the people's Pope, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because non-Catholics are just as enamored of him and really honored to sort of be in his presence as Catholics are.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting in the green room to do a CNN interview, and one of the other people in that green room was a Jew who just went on and on and on about how much he admired and loved and respected this Pope.
Mm-hmm.
So I really do think he falls into that very, very small category of people who just transcends all those boundaries.
Did he say anything that was surprising to you, or did he say anything that made you think, I just wish he hadn't said that?
Not really. You know, I think we expected him to say things about environmental sustainability, about income inequality, about the care and respect for the poor. But still, it was very moving the way he chose to speak about those things.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one complete surprise, at least for me, perhaps others saw it coming, but in his address to Congress, he very explicitly and very strongly called for the end of the death penalty.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see that coming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm delighted by it,
mm-hmm.
But I was not expecting that, and certainly not as direct and forceful as he made it.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real surprise to me. And, of course, I thought the speech to Congress, his use of the four sort of iconic people in American history as the basis for what he wanted to say, I thought was simply brilliant,
mm-hmm.
Partly because it helps Americans own that. But it also represented a, a remarkable diversity itself. I mean, Lincoln is probably no surprise. Dr. King is certainly an appropriate and but not a surprise. But Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton, I think, were kind of brilliant choices. Dorothy Day, both because she's a woman, and because it reflects this social ministry, this justice ministry that this Pope seems so committed to, the care for the most vulnerable, the marginalized, the dispossessed. And, of course, she sort of embodies that ministry. And Thomas, this is very interesting. So Thomas Merton, you know, is known for his spirituality and so on. But Thomas Merton was one of those people who would not be bound by his Roman Catholic faith. And as we know, he spent much time in the Far East, was very enamored of meditation techniques from other faiths. And I think it signals the breadth of care that this Pope has. It's not just for Catholics. It's for all the world's people. Mm-hmm. And then when he finished the congressional speech and came out onto the balcony, he did what seemed to be an impromptu few words to the assembled crowds. Mm-hmm. And what he said in that at the end, I just found very moving, which was, if you are a believer and if you pray, would you please pray for me? And then he says, if you're not a believer and you don't pray, send good wishes my way. And I think for the head of the Roman Catholic Church to acknowledge in a respectful and positive way non-believers will go a long way to softening the sometimes harsh impression people have of the Roman Catholic Church. And I think that was very reflective of what Thomas Merton taught in his life and ministry.
You know, that was one of the most significant signs of sensitivity and compassion that I could imagine. And I think you're right. I think that makes a very positive impression on all Americans and not just a few. Gene, you are one of the most hope-filled people I know.
That's our business, though, isn't it?
Well, it is our business, but not everybody always does business. So I want to ask you, from a pastoral perspective, what impact do you hope the Pope's trip will have on Americans, Catholic and non-Catholic alike?
It remains to be seen what kind of an effect. There are many talking about, will this have a softening effect on the polarization that we find in Congress? I don't know that I'm that hopeful, because I think that polarization is deep and broad, but one hopes so. What I do think is that we can expect rather remarkable things from this Pope. Mm-hmm. I've often said, even if the Pope wants to change some things in his church, it's a pretty big ship to turn around, even if the captain wants to do so.
Yes.
And there are lots of forces at work to undermine the kinds of change this Pope seems to have in mind, because no institution, including the church, likes change, and there are always forces against it. So I think one of the interesting things to look for as we move forward is how successful is this particular captain at navigating these rough waters of these days?
Yeah.
Certainly, this trip for Americans has brought us incredibly closer to this Pope and to his aspirations for the world. I think it just remains to be seen whether this is going to be one massive four-day photo op or whether this is actually touching people's hearts.
That's well said. I'm making an assumption here that you haven't had a meeting with the Pope during this visit. If you had, what would you want to say to him?
No, I have not had the honor of actually meeting him. Uh-huh. If I did, I would probably use it in some ways, a selfish purpose. Mm-hmm. Which is to say, the kind of inner life, the spiritual life that this pope has, moves him to embrace those who are marginalized and dispossessed and scorned in some ways by society. And I think I would probably use that as a way to ask him and to plead with him to get to know gay and lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people.
Yeah.
He talks about families all the time. I would want to talk to him about our family, mm-hmm. and to just ask him to entertain the notion that indeed our families want the same things that any family wants, mm-hmm. and that if he got to know us, his ideas and his theological understandings of us and our lives might very well change. I would invite him to that kind of exploration. And I would invite him to resist those forces within the Curia and the people around him to, quote-unquote, protect him from us. I'd probably be selfish in that way. But then again, I might be so starstruck and so honored to be in his presence that I would be completely tongue-tied, as out of character as that would be for me.
The very honest Right Reverend Gene Robinson was the first openly gay man to be elevated to bishop in the Episcopal Church. He's the author of several invaluable books, including God Believes in Love, Straight Talk About Gay Marriage, and In the Eye of the Storm, Swept to the Center by God. Today, Bishop Gene serves on a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C., Thank you for being sensitive to our listeners' needs to hear your voice, because it's always helpful. And I appreciate so much you taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, Wilton, thank you so much. And I will just remind you that you never have to twist my arm to talk with you, because it's always a great pleasure and a great honor. Thank you for having me on.
A few weeks ago, Rabbi Jack Moline, Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance, was with us. We discussed what he hoped we would and would not hear from Pope Francis during his unprecedented address to a joint session of Congress. Well, that address happened on Thursday morning of this past week, and I'm very happy to have Jack back with us once again to analyze what we heard, as well as some other pressing issues at the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Jack, thanks for being here again.
Thanks for having me again, Wilton. It's always a pleasure.
We have anticipated this speech, and now we've heard what went on. What caught your ear during the Capitol Hill address?
I, like a lot of people, I'm reflecting on his discussion of families and what constitutes families. I think he threaded a needle very carefully in terms of choosing his words, but I still maintain a certain amount of concern that he was attempting to advance an image of family that does not include some of the more profound and welcome changes that we've had in America over the course of the last summer, including the affirmation that marriage equality produces family equality, and that we have to continue to advocate for those values within American society. What Roman Catholics believe and other religious groups believe about the nature of family is, of course, up to them and protected by the Constitution. But what Americans do is also protected by the Constitution and not affected by what any particular religious group believes.
Yeah. Do you think he approached it in a way that gave a little bit of comfort to the diversity that was in the room, or did he come down, in your opinion, on one side harder than another?
Well, I have a view of this that is both from high up in the air and very close to the ground. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at the entirety of his speech, and particularly his emphasis on the work of Dr. King and Dorothy Day, and on the contemplative approach that he emphasized with Thomas Merton, I think it's fair to defend that the Pope was defending a broad range of perspectives on society. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to follow the lead of a lot of our more right-wing analysts who are trying to drill down into what he was saying to justify the case against gay marriage. I think very much in keeping with his personality, he left open lots of possibilities without shying away from his own convictions.
Yeah. Oh, that's well said. What did you think about him dealing with fundamentalism?
Look, I think if there was anything that delighted and surprised me in his speech, it was that call for an understanding that, in my words, religion serves humanity rather than the other way around. And I think we have a lot to look forward to with a sense of openness emanating from the Holy See as a result of his representations here.
Yeah. Did he talk about climate change as much as you thought he would?
He did not emphasize it quite as much, but I thought he framed it magnificently as a responsibility that we have to future generations. And he also went into some very dangerous territories in a conservative-dominated legislative chamber when he talked about capitalism. And frankly, the two things go together, the exploitation of resources being something that he cautioned against, not just because it is something that disadvantages the poor, but because the notion that we can exploit whatever is at hand is dangerous for the home we live in. So I thought it was very elegant and very eloquent, but of course the devil is always in the details. So the nice response that he got from those who were listening will now have to be considered outside the religious context of his representation as a matter of legislation and policy.
You know, you and I, Jack, talked about our shared concern that a faith leader, no matter how prominent, needs to avoid any attempt at dictating U.S. government policy. Did the Pope come off as being a pastor or as a politician?
Oh, dear. His approach was definitely pastoral, Welton. But I'm willing to take Speaker Boehner at his word that he invited the Pope as a world leader and as the head of the nation of the Vatican and not as the Holy Father of the Roman Catholic Church. So I think that his gentle approach to policy meant that most people who were there listening to him with their legislative ears on rather than their church ears on heard a very good articulation of policy positions he hoped that Congress would embrace, but presented in a way that was far less confrontational than other world leaders who've addressed Congress.
I actually was surprised at listening to some of the people traveling with the Pope who obviously had been briefed on what they should say about why the Pope was here and what he would be doing. And the ones that I heard were very upfront in saying he is the head of a government as well as being a pastor for everybody that wants him across the world. And yes, he needs to speak as a politician as well as being a pastoral leader. I was surprised by that.
I hate to hand anything to Bill O'Reilly, Welton, but you will recall that I was deployed on behalf of Interfaith Alliance years ago when Pope John Paul II died and flags were lowered to half staff in this country, and we had some problems with that. And Mr. O'Reilly said to me on his television program that he found my objection to be illegitimate because the Pope was the head of state. He had a secretary of state and a full complement of diplomats, and that this was not lowering the flag in honor of a religious leader. Maybe I have to agree with him all these years later.
Well, you know what? Whatever anybody thinks about what you just said, I think historically that's the first time anybody ever complimented O'Reilly on the show. talking about critics, Paul Gosar, a Republican member of Congress who's also a Roman Catholic, skipped the event over the Pope's focus on climate change. Do you have any thoughts about that?
I think that if anything illustrates the Pope's emphasis on Thomas Merton's openness to dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It is that we had most of the members of Congress and most of the members of government who were there to hear someone they knew they would not agree with on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I think anybody who closes his or her mind to hearing dissent is not acting within the best values of the United States of America.
Hmm.
We have a two-party system because we presume that there's going to be more than one policy position on the matters that affect American lives. And we have elections so that people have a choice and they can indicate what they agree with and what they disagree with. Anybody who absents himself from a speech because they don't want to hear what's going to be said, I think is making a huge mistake and can't very well represent diverse positions within his or her own constituency.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's different than saying, I don't think it's appropriate for a particular individual to address Congress, or I don't like the way someone was invited. I know we had this controversy the last time Speaker Boehner invited somebody to address Congress. But to say, I know what he's going to say and I don't want to hear it, mm-hmm. I have a problem with that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, neither one of us is Catholic, and I don't know what you've been thinking watching the really hyper actions that some people have seemed to demonstrate over the fact that he is in Washington and was speaking to Congress and to other audiences. I thought the media was really more enthusiastic in some ways than I've ever heard them be about the fact that a religious leader is in town, and I think they saw him as a religious leader, not so much as a politician. I'm curious both what you thought and what you've heard from your friends and allies who are Catholics about what this visit from the Pope means.
So one of the hallmarks of your tenure as president of Interfaith Alliance was your rightful emphasis on the potential for religion to have healing power in our society. And if I'm going to applaud the Pope's visit here as a religious leader, it is that it has been recognized, and especially in the media, that somebody of his demeanor, even though he is deeply devoted to values that some people will agree with and some people will completely disagree with, but his demeanor allows for religion to have that healing power, to invite people in, to address matters of concern in a way that is positive and effective.
Hmm.
And so I'm fine with the media's attention to him as a religious leader, because in the end, we sometimes forget this, but even though the media can shape perception, in the end, the way he behaves is the way he should be judged, and he's behaved himself in a manner that is appropriate for a head of state. He's got other responsibilities, and those are not state occasions, and so I'm okay with that. In terms of what I've heard from people in my community, I think probably the biggest manufactured story of this visit was his activities yesterday during Yom Kippur. I received so many press inquiries from people wanting to know if Jews were offended that he was coming on Yom Kippur. And nobody that I spoke with in the Jewish community was offended. It was only people wanting to know if we were offended who made this a story.
Yeah.
He came on a state visit. He came to minister to his flock in the time he wasn't interacting with government. And he didn't want a seat in synagogue, which meant nobody had to give up a place for him. So what possible objection could we have?
Yeah, yeah. Though all eyes seem to have been on the Pope this week, there's been another news story that has to be addressed. Ben Carson, who's making a strong run for the Republican presidential nomination, was on Meet the Press last week.
So do you believe that Islam is consistent with the Constitution?
No, I don't. I do not. I would not advocate that we put a Muslim in charge of this nation. I absolutely would not agree with that.
Jack, that got some mainstream criticism, but at the same time, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins came out in strong support. I want to know what you thought.
This is only the most recent example of what I'm calling the politics of otherness that has infected candidates in all sorts of races, but most especially in the race for president. We've had people condemning gays and lesbians. We've had people condemning people of Mexican origin, whether they're here legally or not. We've had people condemning the poor, and we've had people condemning the rich. It is almost as if the path to the White House is paved with making one group of people feel that they're better than somebody else in the United States. And that's, I think, what Dr. Carson has done. It is reprehensible for him to speak that way of American citizens who are members of the Muslim faith community, just as it's reprehensible for any candidate to designate any class of Americans as being less than equal. I'm very distressed when we have anyone pointing at a minority and saying they're only four-fifths a citizen of the United States. That bothers me tremendously.
Rabbi Jack Moline has served as a congregational rabbi for over 30 years, most recently at the Agudas Akim congregation in Alexandria, Virginia. Having held a number of leadership positions for numerous Jewish interfaith and community organizations, today, thank God, Jack is executive director at Interfaith Alliance. Jack, as always, let me thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio. But more than that, let me thank you for the large influence that you are exerting in a nation that badly needs you and Interfaith Alliance. Thank you.
Thank you, Welton. And let me encourage your listeners to help us continue that effort by supporting State of Belief Radio and by supporting Interfaith Alliance.
Our producer, Ray Kirstein, has been digging deep in the vaults to find another memorable interview from years gone by. Ray, what have you come up with this week?
Oh, Welton, look at this one. I know it's one of your all-time favorites. This is that conversation you had with outspokenly Christian, openly lesbian, country superstar Shelley Wright back in September of 2010.
I had a gun in my mouth ready to pull the trigger in early 2006. And let me clarify, I wasn't thinking of taking my life because I'm gay. I was planning on taking my life because I had painted myself into a corner in my hiding. I've never known a day in my life that I haven't had a relationship with God. But when I realized that I was a little gay girl in Kansas, I was told enough things by my church and my community and my social surroundings that was a bad thing. So I began a prayer, dear God, please don't let me be gay. I promise to be a good person. I promise not to lie and steal. I promise to do all the things you ask me to do. Please take it away in your name. I pray. Amen. And I began saying this prayer in third grade because that's when I realized that thing in me that was different that I knew about, I knew that I was different from age four, but I identified by third grade that, oh, holy cow, that difference is that I'm gay. So I began that prayer, and I said that prayer every single day of my life, multiple times a day.
I'm sure that the ministers that you had didn't talk about homosexuality every Sunday.
Right.
But you obviously were hearing a message that disturbed you, that felt like negation to you. Mm-hmm. If you tried to summarize the message you got every week in church, what was the message?
Leave it to you to ask me such a pithy question. You're right. They weren't saying homosexuality is bad every week. But when they said it, boy, did I hear it. But the overall message that I received in the many churches I went to, a lot of different types of churches, Christian, but a lot of different brands of Christianity. The overriding message was, don't be this, don't do that, look out for the fear. Like you're going to mess this up, Like, you have 1,000 ways to mess up your salvation.
And yet when you left, you felt comfort, acceptance, mm-hmm. inspiration.
Mm-hmm. I did, and I took comfort in being able to pray to, and I say him because that's just what I was taught. And when I think of God, I do, you know, I've never seen God. I've never seen a guy in a robe or with a beard or anything like that. But my idealization of God, when I think about God and when I've always thought about God, was, you know, a guy in a robe and a beard, you know. So I would take comfort in talking to that guy. And Welton, it seemed insane to me that this person, this being, rather, that was my great protector and my heavenly father and who had created me, he had made me from dust. I thought it was crazy for me to try to keep a secret from him. So I never tried to keep, I knew I couldn't. And I knew he knew that I was a little gay kid. And I also knew that he knew that I was a believer.
You know country music and the country music industry. My perception is that the music industry is not particularly a hotbed of liberalism. And it may not be the first place that someone who is coming out wants to go, but you were already there. What did that do to you, knowing who you are, that you are all right with God and God was all right with you, but the people with whom you had the closest associations were people for whom it was not all right?
Yeah. Well, that realization caused me to end up with the gun in my mouth. It's 1,000 tiny little betrayals that I committed against myself. It was torture. And it occurred to me, I have painted myself into a corner. It doesn't matter the things I have, my financial portfolio, the hit records I've got under my belt, the incredible number of fans that say they love me. I am living a big, fat, stinking lie. And I couldn't find a way out. See, Welton, you know me. I have a plan for things, and that's one of the gifts that God gave me, is a capacity for critical thinking and to sit down and say, okay, let me work out this plan. Here's how I get out of this situation, or here's how I go the next step in my career. I couldn't for the life of me see a way out of this hole. And it occurred to me, well, it'd be better to kill myself. I don't know how to do this.
So what happened? You obviously didn't kill yourself.
No, I came.
And what?
Close.
I know you came close.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get the gun out of your mouth?
It was at maybe 2 a.m, and I went downstairs. I had had a 9mm gun that my parents had bought me back in 1991. I stared into a mirror there in the foyer, and I prayed for God to forgive me for what I was about to do. And I put the gun in my mouth and positioned my thumb on the trigger. I was ready to fire the weapon. And as I looked in the mirror, I was unrecognizable to myself. And I recall that my eyes were just as wide as saucers. It shocked me that I wasn't crying. I thought, don't people cry when they kill themselves? Isn't rock bottom, you're supposed to be a mess and a puddle of mush and crying and scream, you know, I felt too detached. And as I had the gun in my mouth and I was looking at myself, I'm not sure how long went by, how many seconds or even minutes went by with this gun in my mouth. And I don't know how many of y'all have had the end of a gun in your mouth, but that's a big, cold weapon, a 9mm. And I heard a noise. And it wasn't the pop of the gun. It was my heart beating in my head and in my chest. I could actually, I could begin to hear it. Gung, 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 gung. And I was fear, and it was, I reached my emotional zenith, and I looked in the mirror and I became fuzzy, and I realized, I'm crying now. And that was the dam breaking. That was me not looking at me outside of my body. I finally went back into my body, and I was staring back out through my eyes. I didn't have an epiphany of, you can't do this tonight. Don't take your life. But I began to be back in my body and feeling all that I was feeling and feeling those emotions. And I took the gun out of my mouth. I knew that, at that moment I wouldn't do it. I didn't know that 1 hour later I wouldn't be back down there, but I knew that I wasn't going to do that at the moment. And I put the gun back down on the mantle. And I remember how loud it was, just as it rattled back down to the mantle. And I walked up to the third floor of my bedroom and got into bed. And at that moment, I knew for now, for this hour, for this 2 hours, I can't do it.
What would you say to a teenager who is struggling with the fact that he or she may be gay?
Well, that comes up a lot. And what I would say to them is what I do say, which is, you're not alone. And I send them to a few websites to find information, the Interfaith Alliance and Faith in America and GLSEN and the HRC and GLAAD. But what I would say to them is, you're not alone. I know what you're feeling. Pray more than you've ever prayed, and you are okay.
What would you say to parents who think they have a child who is gay, but they don't want to risk asking?
I would encourage them to plant seeds of compassion, and to somehow, in discussions at the dinner table or in the car, bring up topics that, without making the child feel cornered, get close to your child and make them know that you are a safe place to fall.
What would you say to school teachers?
If there's a teacher who thinks that there might be a gay student or a transgender student, some child who's outside of what the school believes to be normal, I would encourage them to become a part of the Safe Space program. It's a new initiative launched by GLSEN this year, and I happen to be the national spokesperson. And it's as simple as putting a sticker in the window of your classroom that says, this is a safe space. And if you have any inclination as an educator or administrator to be someone that young gay student or transgender student or bisexual student, if you have any inclination that you want to be that safe space for them to come talk to you, put the sticker in your window. And you can go to GLSEN.org, GLSEN.org, to find out about that.
What would you say to the person you meet at one of your performances or that writes on your Facebook, I just wish you hadn't told us. We had so much respect for you. We just don't think homosexuality is right. Why didn't you just keep it to yourself?
Yeah, and that's happened. I had somebody ask me why I just couldn't shut up and sing. I'm a singer about 6 hours a day, but I'm a human being 24 hours a day, and I'm a Christian 24 hours a day. And I know that there are others. I didn't just shut up and sing because there is a child who has the courage to tell his parent, "Mom, Dad, I think I'm gay, and I don't want that singular message that that young person gets, that there's something wrong with them, that they're a freak show, that they're godless." I needed to stand up and say, "You guys have all this respect for me. You like me. You think I'm a heck of a gal, a great American. I need to give you my entire truth, and then you can do with it what you will. My entire truth is that I am gay. I'm a Christian. I'm a sister. I may be your favorite country singer, but this is my whole truth. And if that in any way makes that kid sitting on the edge of his bed in Scottsdale feel less alone and less inclined to pull the trigger or swallow the pill, that's my job as a Christian and as an honest person."
Million-selling country star Shelley Wright came out as gay in May of 2010. This conversation first aired in September of that same year. On May 18, 2013, Shelley Wright and her wife, Lauren Blitzer Wright, welcomed twin boys into their family. The couple had married less than a year after this interview, on August 20, 2011. The ceremony was co-officiated by the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. We're going to keep revisiting the treasure trove of interviews we've recorded over almost 10 years of State of Belief Radio. If there's a particular conversation that stuck in your memory, I hope you'll let us know so we can share it with our new listeners. I bet you know someone who would benefit from hearing what you've heard today. I encourage you to share this program with them. We make it real easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter and, of course, at stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you'll find information on supporting this show financially. Donations from listeners like you have been an important part of making State of Belief possible for almost 10 years now. I want to thank you if you've been among our generous supporters, and I want to urge you to join others in keeping this show on the air. The website, one more time, is stateofbelief.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show, as well as an archive of past shows, extended interviews, and transcripts. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us again next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, he was.